Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 254. It's Monday, April 15th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get started with a report card on the state of Ohio. This is the annual health value dashboard for 2024 from the Health Policy Institute of Ohio. This report covers dozens and dozens and dozens of metrics, but we're going to start with the one that's most near and dear to public health, and the best measure of the overall population health is the population health section. And Ohio ranked 43rd out of 51. That includes all the states and Washington, D.C. This is the lowest we've ranked in the last 5 years, and we've been at 43 each of the last 4 years. So taking a sampling of some of these just to see how we're doing, Ohio ranks 45th on health behaviors. One of the examples of that that's most important, the leading cause of death, is smoking, tobacco use in the United States. We rank 46th in adult smoking rate at 17.1%. Now, a little bit of good news with that, we were actually moderately improved by lowering the adult smoking rate, but we were actually greatly improved by reducing the youth e-cigarette use, which of course is one of the upcoming ways of getting nicotine addiction, and e-cigarettes are unhealthy as well. Okay, next subcategory under public health is conditions and diseases, which we rank 43rd in. The one area that we rank in the top half of states was suicide deaths, but we rank way down in the, generally in the 40s. Oral health, adult depression, adult diabetes, heart disease mortality, COVID-19 mortality, we were actually 42nd. And worst of all, we ranked 47th on drug overdose deaths. Okay, that's it for population health. Let's look at another category, the healthcare system. Ohio ranked 38th among the 51 states and D.C. One example of that was hospital utilization. How well are we using the hospital resources that we have? We ranked 49th in Ohio. And the examples of why we did so poorly in that was we ranked 45th in potentially avoidable emergency department visits for employer-insured enrollees. So this is just a measure of conditions that should be preventable that were not. And we ranked 47th on the 30-day hospital readmissions. And this is for employer-insured enrollees, meaning that the hospital provided subpar care and you're getting a higher rate of readmissions. And under the healthcare system structure, we ranked 44th on primary care physicians, one of the basic foundations of a healthcare system. Okay, the next category is public health and prevention. This would be that system. We ranked 36th in Ohio. We actually ranked well on public health system workforce at 7th. Way to go, Ohio. We ranked number 2, I think this is our highest ranking of anything, is on the accreditation of local health departments. Way to go, Ohio. Almost 78% of local health departments are accredited. But we ranked 48th when you look at the state public health workforce. That is the number of state public health agency full-time equivalents per 100,000 population. Dragging the bottom there. Okay, in another subcategory under public health and prevention, we have health promotion and prevention. We did very well, ranking 10th on youth marijuana use. That means the lower use is a lower number, higher ranking. But we are dragging the bottom at 43rd in ranking of seatbelt use, as an example. We actually ranked 51st, that is last among all the states in D.C. for emergency preparedness and surveillance. So this is a basic public health function, paying attention to what's going on, defining problems, and then, defining them well, like they say, a problem well defined is half solved. So we rank 29th in the number of epidemiologists, so that's roughly in the middle. But when you're looking at emergency preparedness funding per capita, we ranked 44th, and we ranked dead last at 51 in what they're calling health security surveillance, which measures actions to monitor and detect health threats and to identify where hazards start and spread so that they can be contained rapidly. Of course, if you don't pay attention to it, it doesn't happen, right? Okay, moving to another category, social and economic environment. This gets at a lot of social determinants of health that are broader than health per se, but have a great impact on population health. We ranked 31st as a state in this subcategory. And within that, in education, we ranked 30th. We did well on fourth grade reading, ranking 8th in the nation. Way to go, Ohio. But when it comes to employment and poverty, we ranked 39 on both adult and child poverty. One good news in the social and economic environment, we ranked 13th in civic engagement. That was defined by voter registration, where we ranked 11th, and the voting rates, where we ranked 16th. Way to get out there and vote, Ohioans. Next subcategory, physical environment. We ranked 37th overall. We ranked very poorly at 49th for air, water, and toxic substances. We ranked 41st for outdoor air pollution, 47th for children in a household that has a person who smokes, and 48th for toxic pollutants. Yikes. And we also ranked 40th for food insecurity. Unfortunately, Ohio does not rate well in public health and health measures compared to other states. And unfortunately, the U.S. as a whole, when compared to comparable nations, other so-called industrialized nations, we fare much worse. So Ohio is faring worse in a nation that's faring worse to comparable nations. Maybe we'll have to go for the most improved category. Lots of room for improvement. Okay, and on that front, we'll go to some national policy that's actually an improvement. This is from the Associated Press. New WIC rules include more money for fruits and veggies. They also expand food choices. The federal program that helps pay for groceries for millions of low-income mothers, babies, and young kids will soon emphasize more fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, as well as provide a wider choice of foods from different cultures. The final rule changes for the program known as WIC were announced last Tuesday by the Food and Nutrition Service and will take effect within 2 years with some exceptions. Last updated a decade ago, the new WIC rules make permanent a bump in monthly cash vouchers for fruits and vegetables, something that was first enacted during the COVID-19 pandemic. Shoppers can also add canned fish, fresh herbs, and lactose-free milk to their carts, among other changes. The voucher piece will take effect by June, officials said. It places a heavy emphasis on fruits and vegetables, which we think is an important component of a healthy diet, said Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's designed to fill the nutrition gaps that are often in the diets of many of us. The WIC program served an average of about 6.6 million low-income Americans each month in 2023, at a cost of a little more than $7 billion. It's designed to supplement the food budgets for pregnant, nursing, and postpartum women, as well as to feed babies and young kids up to age 5. That's done by providing vouchers to mothers and children who qualify and specifically listing the amounts and types of foods that they can buy. But officials have said that only about half of those eligible are enrolled in the Supplemental Nutrition Program for women, infants, and children. Under the new rules, fruits and vegetable vouchers in 2024 will provide $26 per month for kids age 1 through 4, $47 per month for pregnant and postpartum women, and $52 per month for breastfeeding women. The changes also expand access to whole grains like quinoa, wild rice, and millet, and to foods such as teff and whole wheat naan. They also remove or reduce monthly allowances for juice and cut back on allowances for milk. Food plans in the program are based on recommendations from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine and the federal 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. The plan failed to include a change requested by top allergists in the U.S. that would have added peanut products to foods allowed for babies aged 6 months to 11 months to help prevent peanut allergies. Research published in 2015 showed early introduction to peanut foods can reduce the chance of allergy development in kids who are at high risk, and several U.S. guidelines suggest exposing high-risk children to peanuts as early as 4 months. Adding peanuts to the WIC guidelines may have prevented more than 35,000 infants from developing a peanut allergy, said Dr. Gideon Lack of King's College London, who led the study. But federal nutrition officials concluded the change was, quote, outside the scope of the final rule. Dr. Ruchi Gupta, a pediatrics professor and child allergy expert at Northwestern University, called the omission disappointing. She noted that WIC enrollees often include children of color who are at higher risk of developing dangerous peanut allergies. The decision can only increase disparities we are already seeing in food allergy prevalence. So overall, good news, but still more room for improvement. And next up on another federal regulatory change, I've been waiting for this one for a long time. This from MedPage Today. Justice Department issues final rule to end the gun show loophole. The gun show loophole that allowed some buyers to purchase guns without going through a background check is now history, thanks to a final rule published last Thursday by the Justice Department. Under this regulation, it will not matter if guns are sold on the internet, at a gun show, or at a brick-and-mortar store. If you sell guns predominantly to earn a profit, you must be licensed, and you must conduct background checks, Attorney General Merrick Garland said. This regulation is a historic step in the Justice Department's fight against gun violence. It will save lives. The final rule also closes the fire sale loophole, a similar exemption from running background checks for those gun dealers closing up shop and selling all their inventory, by clarifying how firearms dealers who go out of business or lose their license must go about liquidating their inventory. Although exact numbers are hard to come by, approximately 23,000 unlicensed gun dealers will be affected by the rule. But there are some situations that will not be affected, such as occasional family firearm transfers. In addition, the rule provides common sense clarity to make sure that true hobbyists and true collectors can advance or liquidate their professional and personal collection without fear of violating the law. The new rule would help prevent more domestic abusers from buying guns, the officials said, noting that according to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, about 250,000 domestic abusers have been stopped by the background check system since 1998. Having more dealers become licensed will mean that when domestic abusers try to buy guns, they're going to be stopped by the background check system. One investigation found that 1 in 9 individuals who try to buy guns online from private sellers would fail that check. So we know it is essential to expand background checks to all sales to ensure that if someone's prohibited because of domestic abuse or a protective order, that we could stop that sale from happening. The administration also has implemented the Denial Notification Act of 2022 so that when an abuser tries to buy a gun and fails, a notification goes to local law enforcement so they can step in and take action and make sure they go investigate why someone who's prohibited because of domestic violence would be trying to buy a gun in the first place. So we think this is directly connected and that this is a very important tool to help keep guns out of the hands of prohibited and dangerous people. A long time coming, and let's have a nice long celebration for that one. Okay, next up, moving to an area where we've regressed on public policy, that's abortion rights. This from the 19th. States that restrict divorce during pregnancy also have abortion bans. Experts are raising concerns about what the intersection, now in four states, means for victims of domestic violence. It's a combination that can be fatal, say experts on domestic violence. A study recently published in the Journal of the American College of Surgeons found that states that restrict abortion access from 2018 to 2020 had a 75% higher rate of peripartum homicide, that is, people who are killed while pregnant or in their first year after giving birth, than states without restrictions. The same trend did not hold in homicide rates for men. Firearms were used in 63% of all peripartum homicides. These statistics underscore the connection between reproductive rights, domestic violence, and gun violence in the United States. Calls to the National Domestic Violence Hotline about reproductive coercion have gone up 98% since the Dobbs ruling. Homicide is the leading cause of death for pregnant and postpartum people in the United States. Between 3 and 9% of American women will experience domestic violence during pregnancy. The majority of women who are abused before becoming pregnant continue to experience abuse during pregnancy. An abusive partner oftentimes views pregnancy as a loss of control, that their victim will now not be solely dedicated to them, but will have somebody else that diverts their attention away from their abusive partner. Barring pregnant people's ability to leave a marriage when pregnant, while also banning abortion, seems likely to further elevate the risk of death. Not only are states now saying that you must stay pregnant against your will, but during that pregnancy, the state is not going to let you legally divorce your abusive partner. I can't think of anything more outrageous or cruel. And next up, another story, just how much the overturning of Roe has affected the American population. This one about permanent contraception. This from Medical Express. First national study of Dobbs ruling's effect on permanent contraception among young adults. The first study to evaluate the effect of the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization ruling on permanent contraception procedures among young adults nationwide was published in a JAMA Health Forum research letter. The study, authored by policy researchers from the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health and Boston University, underscores how the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court ruling changed preferences for permanent contraception among people aged 18 to 30, who are more likely to have abortions and are also more likely to experience sterilization regret compared to people over 30. The study is also the first to assess how the Dobbs ruling changed permanent contraception procedures among females relative to males. Following the Dobbs decision, the authors found permanent sterilization procedures among young adults abruptly increased nationwide. The magnitude of this increase was twice as high for tubal sterilizations relative to vasectomies. Over time, tubal sterilizations continued to increase. For vasectomies, however, the initial jump was not sustained. Compared to vasectomy, tubal ligation procedures are far more complex and are anywhere from 2 to 6 times more expensive. Tubal ligation reversal requires major surgery, whereas vasectomy reversal is much less invasive. The major difference in patterns of these two procedures likely reflects the fact that young women are overwhelmingly responsible for preventing pregnancy and disproportionately experience the health, social, and economic consequences of abortion bans. So just further dividing men and women's health status and status overall in America. Okay, well, next up, finally, have some data about the results of the great Medicaid unwinding that's happened over the last year or so. This from Medical Express. Almost 1 in 4 people disenrolled from Medicaid are now uninsured. Nearly a quarter of Americans who lost their pandemic-era Medicaid coverage say they are now without any health insurance, a new survey finds. More than half, 54% of these currently uninsured adults cited costs as the reason keeping them from having coverage. Almost 1 in 5, 19%, of all people who had been on Medicaid in early 2023 were disenrolled at some point later that year. 70% of that group said they subsequently went through a temporary period of being uninsured. Most did eventually gain insurance. 47% managed to reapply and get reinstated on Medicaid. So that's about half the people that got thrown off. Basically, were thrown off even though they were in fact eligible. Not very good, very efficient way to disenroll people when they're actually eligible for the program. And another 28% said they found insurance via their work, Medicare, the Affordable Care Act's marketplace, or military-based healthcare. More than a third of folks who sought to regain some kind of coverage said they found the process difficult, and nearly half called it stressful. Long phone call time waits, excessive paperwork, and trouble figuring out what paperwork was needed were common complaints. Interruptions in coverage can have an almost immediate impact on health. More than half of the folks, 56%, said they missed needed health care or skipped prescriptions as they waited to regain coverage. Among people who have found a form of health insurance other than Medicaid, worries about cost remain. More than three-quarters of folks with insurance say they are worried about affording the cost of healthcare services. Only 47% of people who retained Medicaid felt the same. So this last fact is just highlighting the point that because Medicaid doesn't have a lot of copays, deductibles or premiums, it's all zero, it's much less stressful, and you're much less likely to have, you know, financial problems related to healthcare, having good coverage. But those people that have these other forms of insurance, private insurance through the ACA or whatever, there's often a lot of deductibles, premiums, copays, that type of thing. And over three quarters of those are worried about affording the cost of healthcare services. Next up, we have an element of healthcare that can provide a lot better healthcare. This from Stat News. High physician empathy could offer patients with low back pain lasting benefits, study shows. Amid the many demands of practicing medicine, doctors can have less time and energy for their patients, and those relationships can suffer. Yet research has shown that when physicians show empathy, they can generally lead to better clinical outcomes, at least over the near term. Now, a new study published in JAMA Network Open demonstrates that those benefits can extend longer and be even more effective than some clinical therapies in dealing with lower back pain, which affects half of the U.S. population in any given year. Researchers observing patients with lower back pain over the course of 12 months found that treatment by very empathetic physicians was associated with a better outcome at the end of the year than treatment by a slightly empathetic physician. And those positive outcomes were greater than those associated with non-pharmacological treatments, such as exercise therapy, yoga, massage therapy, spinal manipulation, acupuncture, and cognitive behavioral therapy, opioid therapy, and lumbar spine surgery. Nobody's done any real long-term studies such as the one we've done here for the last 12 months, said John Licciardone, professor of family medicine at University of North Texas Health Science Center and the first author of the study. What he found most surprising is that empathy is associated with better outcomes, but there are also outcomes that really appear to last for a long period of time. Lower back pain is a very common condition, with 619 million people affected globally in 2020, according to the World Health Organization. In the U.S., up to 85% of people experience some form of back pain during their lifetime, and 50% have recurrent episodes within a calendar year. The researchers turned to data from the Nationwide Pain Registry for Epidemiological, Clinical, and Interventional Studies and Innovation and employed an empathic scoring system known as CARE, or Consultation and Relational Empathy. Run through the University of North Texas Health Science Center, the registry enrolls volunteers in chronic lower back pain between 21 and 79 years old. After looking at patient-reported outcomes based on their level of pain and their ability to function, researchers found that across the board, patients who had very empathetic doctors had scores that reflected that they had less pain, were less likely to feel depressed, and less likely to have anxiety or other conditions that might interfere with their quality of life. The results of this research suggest that physicians should look beyond the biological underpinnings of disease. Sometimes there are psychological factors and social factors that contribute to how a patient interprets their pain. So if we address only the biological aspect by putting needles, doing the surgeries, we might actually miss some opportunities to improve patient care. All physicians who Stat spoke with mentioned that physicians should take more time to treat their patients as human beings, and that empathy should be emphasized while students are learning and throughout their professional careers. Doctors who treat chronic conditions should take these results into consideration when interacting with patients. Sometimes they're not asking for a magic cure, magic needle, magic knife. What they care for is that they want to be heard and they want to be understood, and there was someone to help them along the way. So wow, taking more time to treat your patients as human beings, another radical concept. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my guarantee to you is if you listen to the show for 1 year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And should this turn out to not be true, I will refund triple your money back. Okay, well, next up, let's go to one of the pillars of health, sleep. This from the Associated Press. A majority of Americans say they would feel better if they slept more. A Gallup poll found 57% of Americans say they would feel better if they could get more sleep, while only 42% say they are getting as much sleep as they need. That's a first in Gallup polling since 2001. In 2013, when Americans were last asked, it was just about the reverse, 56% saying they got the needed sleep and 43% saying they didn't. Younger women under the age of 50 were especially likely to report they aren't getting enough rest. The poll also asked respondents to report how many hours of sleep they usually got per night. Only 26% said they got 8 or more hours, which is around the amount that sleep experts say is recommended for health and mental well-being. Just over half, 53%, reported getting 6 to 7 hours, and 20% said they got 5 hours or less, a jump from the 14% who reported getting the least amount of sleep in 2013. And just to make you feel even more tired, in 1942, the vast majority of Americans were sleeping more. Some 59% said they slept 8 or more hours, while 33% said they slept 6 to 7 hours. What even is that? The poll doesn't get into reasons why Americans aren't getting to sleep, the sleep they need, and since Gallup last asked the question in 2013, there's no data breaking down the particular impact of the last 4 years in the pandemic era. But what's notable, said Sarah Fioroni, senior researcher at Gallup, is the shift in the last decade toward more Americans thinking they would benefit from more sleep, and particularly the jump in the number of those saying they get 5 or less hours of sleep. That 5 hours or less category was almost not really heard of in 1942. There's almost nobody that said they slept 5 hours or less then. In modern American life, there's also been this pervasive belief about how sleep was unnecessary, that it was this period of inactivity where little to nothing was actually happening, and that it took up time that could have been better used, said Joseph Dzerzhowski, Vice President for Research and Scientific Affairs at the National Sleep Foundation. It's only relatively recently that the importance of sleep to physical, mental, and emotional health has started to percolate more into the general population. So why are we awake all the time? One likely reason for American sleeplessness is cultural, a long-standing emphasis on industriousness and productivity. It has been a core part of American culture for centuries. You could make the argument that, in the secularized form over the centuries, becomes just a general principle that the morally correct person is somebody who doesn't waste their time. Jennifer Sherman, who has seen that in action, in her research in rural American communities over the years, the sociology professor at Washington State University says a common theme among people she interviews is the importance of having a solid work ethic. That applied not only to paid labor, but unpaid labor as well, like making sure the house was clean. The other side of the coin is a massive amount of disdain for people considered lazy, she added. While a poll only shows a broad shift over the past decade, living through the COVID-19 pandemic may have affected people's sleep patterns. Also discussed in post-COVID life is, quote, revenge bedtime procrastination, in which people put off sleep and instead scroll on social media or binge a show as a way of trying to handle stress. So we have little time during the day that's our own, and we try to cram it at the end of the day, robbing ourselves of sleep. Yes, somewhat self-defeating. Okay, well, next up we have a myth-busting report. This from Medical Express. Deaths of despair among Black Americans surpassed those of White Americans in 2022. A new analysis by researchers at UCLA Health found that mortality rates of middle-aged black Americans caused by the, quote, deaths of despair, that is suicide, drug overdose, and alcoholic liver disease, surpassed the rate of white Americans in 2022. Native Americans also had more than double the rate of both black and white Americans that year. The results of the research, published in the journal JAMA Psychiatry, are the latest from UCLA Health to counter a nearly decade-old narrative that, quote, deaths of despair have primarily impacted white Americans. The deaths of despair theory rose to prominence following a 2015 study that analyzed rising midlife mortality and decreasing life expectancy in the U.S. from 1999 to 2013. The study became a focus of ongoing national discourse after it found white Americans had the highest mortality rates from these causes, at 72 per 100,000 people in 2013, which was two times that of black Americans. The findings sparked a narrative that the rising death rates were primarily impacting less educated white Americans who were experiencing a perceived loss of economic and social status. However, data for Native Americans were not included in the 2015 study or in the many follow-up analyses it triggered. A 2023 study by UCLA Health determined that Native Americans have had a considerably higher midlife death rates from deaths of despair compared to white Americans for all available years of data from 1999 through 2021. The analysis found the rate among black Americans tripled from 2013 to 2022, and the deaths of despair in white Americans increased almost 50%. So it's going up in both white and black populations, but it's going up way, way faster among the black Americans who have now overcome white Americans in deaths of despair, which include suicide, drug overdose, and alcoholic liver disease. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit and do a couple environmental stories. First up from CNN, toxic forever chemicals found in excessive levels in global groundwater. Potentially toxic chemicals, PFAS, the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are found in surface and groundwaters around the world at levels much higher than many international regulators allow, a new study found. Called forever chemicals because they fail to break down fully in the environment, PFAS has been used since the 1950s to make consumer products non-stick, oil and water repellent, and resistant to temperature change. Even in locations with no known source of contamination, 31% of groundwater samples exceeded threshold limits proposed in March 2023 by the U.S. EPA, and nearly 70% exceeded standards already set by Health Canada. The EPA proposal, soon expected to be finalized, set a specific limit of 4 parts per trillion for two older legacy chemicals, PFOS and PFOA, while also setting new limits for a mixture of 4 chemicals developed by industry to replace them. So this is an important thing, regulatory, is that when you regulate one chemical, industry often develops very similar chemicals, what we call regrettable substitution, which often have as bad or worse effects, trying to keep one step ahead of regulations. Okay, next up on the global climate change front, this from the Environmental Health Network, Biden administration greenlights massive oil terminal, sparking backlash. The Biden administration has sanctioned a vast oil terminal off Texas, drawing ire from environmentalists. The Biden administration has greenlit a $1.8 billion deepwater oil export terminal off the Texas coast, set to be the largest in the U.S., with a capacity to load 2 million barrels per day. Despite the Maritime Administration's assertion that the terminal meets critical environmental and national interest requirements, environmental groups have criticized the project for contradicting Biden's climate promises. The terminal, expected to start operations in 2027, has faced criticism for potentially increasing greenhouse gas emissions and disregarding local community concerns. And a key quote from this article, "Nothing about this project is in alignment with President Biden's climate and environmental justice goals." That's Kelsey Crane, senior policy advocate of Earthworks. "While this matters, this decision juxtaposes the administration's clean energy ambitions against its actions favoring fossil fuel expansions, directly impacting both global climate policies and local environmental safety." And there's a global accounting problem in all of this. This has been true with both oil and liquid propane or natural gas that is being exported much to Europe. because if you produce it in your country but export it, it's only counted in the country where it's used. So the U.S. is continuing to produce into the world way more fossil fuels than the Earth can stand. But because it gets counts in some other countries, we don't consider it our problem, except for the fact that we live in the same world. Okay, next up, a quick summary of where we're at with hepatitis worldwide. This from Medical Express. Hepatitis viruses kill 3,500 people a day. More than 3,500 people die from hepatitis viruses every day, and the global toll is rising, the World Health Organization warned, calling for swift action to fight the second largest infectious killer. The report said that there are 3,500 deaths per day worldwide from hepatitis infections. 83% of those deaths are from hepatitis B and 17% from hepatitis C. There are effective and cheap generic drugs which can treat these viruses. Yet only 3% of those with chronic Hep B received antiviral treatment by the end of 2022. For Hep C, just 20%, or 12.5 million people, had been treated. These results fall well below the global targets to treat 80% of all people living with chronic Hep B and C by 2030. Viral hepatitis is the second biggest infectious killer, narrowly trailing tuberculosis, or TB. Okay, well, next up, have a story on the bird flu, which I've reported on a fair amount. And while generally the message to the public has been, oh, the risk of bird flu in humans is very low right now, which of course is true for a myriad of health problems at any given day or any given week or even month or perhaps even year. But of course, public health is largely about prevention, looking ahead. And this article is a very good case study in how public health is looking ahead when you've got large amounts of uncertainty and potentially a high risk, need to do something. This from Stat News. H5N1 bird flu in U.S. cattle, a wake-up call to action. The recent detection of H5N1 bird flu in U.S. cattle, coupled with reports of a dairy worker contracting the virus, demands a departure from the usual reassurances offered by federal health officials. While they emphasize there's no cause for alarm and assert diligent monitoring, it's imperative we break from this familiar script. H5N1, a strain of the flu virus known to infect bird species globally and several mammalian species in the U.S. since 2022, has now appeared to have breached a new barrier of intermammalian transmission, as exemplified by the expanding outbreak in dairy cows in several jurisdictions linked to an initial outbreak in Texas. Over time, continued transmission among cattle is likely to yield mutations that will further increase the efficiency of mammal-to-mammal transmission. As the CDC continues to investigate, this evolutionary leap, if confirmed, underscores the adaptability of the H5N1 virus and raises concerns about the next step required for a pandemic, its potential to further evolve for efficient human transmission. Because humans have no natural immunity to H5N1, the virus can be particularly lethal to them. Despite assertions of an overall low risk of H5N1 infection to the general population, the reality is that the understanding of this risk is limited, and it's evolving alongside the virus. The situation could change very quickly, so it is important to be prepared. Comparisons to seasonal flu management underestimate the unique challenges posed by H5N1. Unlike its seasonal counterparts, vaccines produced and stockpiled to tackle bird flu were not designed to match this particular strain and are available in such limited quantities that they could not make a dent in averting or mitigating a pandemic, even if deployed in the early stages to dairy workers. The FDA-approved H5N1 vaccines, licensed in 2013, 2017, and 2020, do not elicit a protective immune response after just one dose. Even after two doses, it is unknown whether the elicited immune response is sufficient to protect against infection or severe disease, as these vaccines were licensed based on their ability to generate an immune response thought to be helpful in preventing the flu. Early studies done by mRNA vaccine companies on seasonal flu are promising, which could be good news here since mRNA vaccines can be made more quickly than vaccines using eggs or cells. Congressional funding is needed to catalyze rapid vaccine development and production. While FDA-approved antiviral drugs like Tamiflu and Xofluza could be an important line of defense against H5N1, logistical barriers impede their timely administration, as they work best when given as early as possible within 48 hours of the onset of symptoms. Most Americans would find it challenging to get a prescription filled for these medicines within the optimal time frame. Streamlining access to stockpiled antiviral drugs through improved test-to-treat measures like behind-the-counter distribution or dedicated telemedicine consultations could vastly improve their effectiveness as a frontline defense. Making plans to do that needs to start now. For vulnerable people, older adults, and anyone who is immunocompromised, clinicians have become accustomed to relying on monoclonal antibodies. Sadly, their performance for flu has been disappointing in many clinical trials and can't be counted on. The need for robust diagnostic capabilities cannot be overstated. H5N1 will not be detected by the typical rapid flu antigen tests that are administered in emergency rooms and many doctors' offices. New tests will have to be made from scratch. The dismantling of diagnostic infrastructure post-COVID-19 and supply chain interruptions, however, pose significant challenges to the availability of such tests. Rapid investment in diagnostic testing, coupled with efforts to secure essential materials, is imperative to ensure timely detection and antiviral treatment. President Biden's emphasis on infrastructure presents a unique opportunity to fortify America's defenses against infectious diseases. A national initiative to enhance indoor air quality in schools and communal spaces could mitigate transmission risks should this virus learn how to efficiently be transmitted between humans, and would pay dividends every respiratory virus season and for years to come. In the face of uncertainty, complacency is not an option. The U.S. must act decisively, acknowledging the potential gravity of the H5N1 situation while leveraging every available resource to safeguard public health. The stakes are too high to repeat past mistakes. Of course, when it comes to prevention, better safe than sorry. And if in the slew of potential infectious diseases that could ravage us, what a tragedy it would be if we prepared for three or four of them that didn't happen, if it allows us to be well prepared for the one that does. Okay, well, let's end the regular reporting on something completely different. This from Medical Express. Artificial intelligence can help people feel heard. That is, unless they learned the message came from AI. A new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has found that AI-generated messages made recipients feel more heard than messages generated by untrained humans, and that AI was better at detecting emotions than these individuals. However, recipients reported feeling less heard when they learned the message came from AI. As AI becomes more ubiquitous in daily life, understanding its potential limitations in meeting human psychological needs becomes more pertinent. With dwindling empathetic connections in a fast-paced world, many are finding their human needs for feeling heard and validated increasingly unmet. So, don't expect unhumans to meet your human needs. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, which is bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 20 bonus articles this week, so let's get rolling. First up, Ohio State of the State address focused on child health. So one thing, Republicans who are interested in talking about public health, make sure not to call it public health. So the governor talked about child health. Probably the most significant initiative was increasing child care vouchers from 145% of poverty up to 200% of poverty. The one problem with this is it's based on pandemic money that's going to run out next year. If we're going to be concerned about child health, it should probably be a sustainable effort over more than 1 year. Bonus article two, state Medicaid coverage for tobacco cessation treatments improves, but in most states, access barriers are common. So this is a good news, bad news story. The good news is that things are getting better and more states are offering, 20 states are offering full comprehensive tobacco cessation treatments. The rest of the states have various barriers and problems. Ohio is not one of those, though. Ohio has comprehensive tobacco cessation treatment offered through state Medicaid. Way to go, Ohio. Bonus Article 3, PFAS exposure from seafood may be underestimated. This is a new study that controlled for other sources of PFAS, and we're looking at people with high seafood in their diet, and they had more than expected PFAS. Of course, it's not surprising since much seafood are way up on the food chain where they're not only eating plants, but they're eating other animals and sometimes animals that eat animals. And that just bioconcentrates up the food chain, forever chemicals like PFAS and many other toxins. Bonus Article 4, chemicals stored in home garages linked to ALS risk. ALS risk is a terrible neurologic condition, used to be known as Lou Gehrig's disease, basically a wasting disease. And it's been linked to a bunch of the different chemical exposures that are in home garages. Very interesting study. If your garage isn't attached, there's less of a risk, meaning that, you know, when you get like air circulation stuff between an attached garage, it's different. Very well-designed study. And of course, ALS is not something we know a lot of the precursors, but toxin seems like a likely contributor. Bonus Article 5. Lunchables shouldn't be on school menus due to lead, sodium, cadmium, Consumer Reports tells USDA. So I find this is interesting. So the lead and cadmium levels were higher than they should be, which of course should be very, very, very low because they're both very toxic. But putting sodium sandwiched in between that, pun intended, is sodium, another metal, believe it or not, sodium is a metal, is actually one of the biggest toxins that we have in our diet. We add a lot of sodium through salt into our diet. And Lunchables, as a very highly processed food, have a lot of sodium. But because of all these risks, they're saying it's a bad bet for giving it to our kids on school menus. Bonus Article 6, lead in Lunchables. Why lead keeps showing up where it's not supposed to be? So the lead is the whole Lunchables thing, which kind of triggered this story. But this is a really great overview. If you want a master class in public health, you can look at this, why lead keeps showing up where it's not supposed to be. Probably the easiest storyline to follow is that while we have lead problems in this country, lead problems are much more present in low and middle income countries. And a lot of our supply chains for products, food, etc., come through these places, and we end up getting it in our own country, even though we have halfway decent regulations here. So it just accents the point that you need to have good regulations across the board globally if you're going to control toxic substances from distributing themselves around the world. Bonus Article 7, dietary fiber critical in managing hypertension. So high blood pressure is one of the leading killers in the world, and certainly in this country. Dietary fiber itself seems to change the microbiome and such that's good for our health and keeps blood pressure down. But another thing with dietary fiber is that it's very much associated with potassium intake. If you're eating whole foods like fruits and vegetables, you're going to get a lot of fiber. And getting a decent amount of potassium and not too much sodium is a very important part of controlling high blood pressure. Dietary fiber is the lowest intake in the world in the United States. So there you go. Bonus Article 8. Suicides among college athletes have doubled over the past 20 years, growing faster than other young adults. Part of the postulation of why this might be true is there's a lot of pressure on athletes to perform. Bonus Article 9. Young people are getting unhappier. Lack of childhood freedom and independence may be partly to blame. I reported on this type of thing before, but the one fun fact in this article that I hadn't heard before was that compared to children in the 70s, which I was a child of the 70s, 60s and 70s, have 90% less area to be unsupervised than kids today. We are curating our entire children's life, and they're not getting enough freedom and independence to develop some very important skills to function in the world. Bonus Article 10. As a rule, rape exceptions for abortion don't work. So this is important to know that, you know, there's a lot of talk about, oh, you get rape and incest exceptions. But of course, most of these laws require that you report it in a timely fashion to law enforcement and then go through the courts to get an abortion. This is a massive barrier. Most rapes are never actually reported. And also, particularly in incest cases, reporting to law enforcement can be very complicated and dangerous as well. Bonus Article 11. When rogue brokers switch people's ACA policy, surprising tax problems can follow. So this is a follow-up of the story last week where insurance brokers were, unbeknownst to the people who had the policy, switching their policy so that they can get the commissions. But of course, if this happens, you may be submitting your taxes and find out that the form that's needed is not included, so it gets rejected, and you may not even know why. And then, of course, you can end up owing a lot of money if they misreport your income or the change is just different than what you had actually signed up for. Bonus Article 12, hospitals that make profits should pay taxes. I've reported on this a lot, and the surprising fun fact in this article is that actually for-profit hospitals provide more care than nonprofit. And that's not just overall, that's per hospital. You compare $100 worth of services and for-profit hospitals actually provide more uncompensated care than nonprofits. Hard to tell the difference these days, kind of the race to the bottom with capitalism driving everything. Bonus Article 13. Record number of drugs, that is hundreds, are in short supply around the U.S. So this was something that we became aware of during the pandemic when a lot of supply chains were disrupted. But of course, drug shortages have been present in the U.S. economy for decades. Again, partly a profit-driven thing when you have generics, for instance, that can only compete on price because they're considered equivalent by the FDA. It drives the price down, which is good for consumers, except drug manufacturers don't want to make them because they're no profit or too low profit, can make more money doing something else. Bonus Article 14, surgery more cost-effective than Wegovy in adults with body mass index of 35 plus. So this is interesting because Wegovy, these, you know, so-called miracle weight loss drugs, actually would have to be reducing costs by around 70% in order to be effective as a relatively non-invasive bariatric surgery, weight loss surgery. It's one of those now where they don't have to even cut you. They just, you know, stick the little holes in you and do the surgery. So partly that's because the drug's so expensive and partly because surgery is a one-time thing and you don't have to keep taking the drug for years and years and years. And this was only looking over, you know, 2 or 3 or 5 years. Longer course, it might even be more cost-effective. Bonus Article 15, Congress likely to kick the can on continuing COVID-era telehealth policies. So this is probably another casualty of election year politics. They're just bumping it. Pretty much everybody agrees that having telehealth reimbursed is good for pretty much everybody. But that doesn't mean that Congress is going to do it in an election year particularly. Bonus Article 16, some hospitals are adopting a more non-judgmental response when babies are born exposed to drugs. So this is a good example of a long time public health principle of being non-judgmental. And it's particularly important when you're talking to very vulnerable populations, and that would be pregnant women who are using drugs, can be reported as child abuse or neglect. And this can actually prevent pregnant women from seeking help, either for drug treatment or for prenatal care or maternity care. So some hospitals are learning that a non-judgmental response is actually better for the health of all concerned, the mother and the child. Bonus Article 17, shifts in hair relaxer use to Africa highlight health concerns about equitable regulation of toxic consumer products. So this is a point I made earlier. That, okay, so we're learning that hair relaxers are toxic, So their use is going down in America, but companies just promote it around the world, and the use is growing in Africa. So we need to also regulate toxic consumer products in Africa as well. Bonus article 18, draining the world of fresh water. Our thirst for technology and resource consumption drives extractive industries, overwhelming fresh water supplies. So you can think of pretty much every consumer product you buy is going to have a fossil fuel imprint on it, but it's also going to have a freshwater imprint. Pretty much everything we produce somewhere along the line is going to draw on freshwater supplies, and particularly extractive industries tend to use even more, and we're using them in a completely unsustainable way. Bonus article 19. Texans turn to Europe to thwart methane gas terminals, organizing globally. So folks that, Texans in this case, who are trying to stop these expansion of methane gas terminals, since we want to phase out methane gas, not ramp it up, are actually turning to comrades in Europe in order to help organize to make sure that these gas terminals are not expanded. And of course, organizing in Europe is what is the destination for a lot of this methane gas. Bonus article 20. Is there a place in Congress for the most trusted profession in America, which would happen to be nursing? So doctors are actually overrepresented in Congress, but nurses are not. So another front for political action. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on this and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.